Moin zusammen und Servus in die Runde. A hearty welcome to a new episode of Tommy's Talk. My name is Thomas Schulz. I am your host and I'm so happy to have her as my first English-speaking guest. Annabel Thomas, the founder and CEO of the fabulous Nagneen Whiskey from Scotland. Annabel, 43, married, mother of two. I'm honored to have you. Welcome, Annabel.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you say yes and follow my invitation to today's podcast?
Well, maybe this is one of my weaknesses. I say yes to too many things. Why did I say yes? Well, yeah, I think you wrote me a very intriguing email. I can't remember the details of it now, but you obviously phrased it in a way that piqued my interest.
Great. Hey, thank you for the feedback. Great.
I'm also honored, by the way, to be your first English-speaking guest. What a...
Yes, you should be, actually.
I'll try and throw in a few words of German as we go through.
Okay, fair enough. Annabel, I'm really thankful. I'm really happy to have you. And I'd like to follow my trinity, so to say, of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And my first question is, hey, who's Annabel? Who are you? What did you do before? Tell me, tell us.
I'm a history graduate to start
cool.
with, which I know is strange in Germany, but in the UK, we don't go to university to study anything that is relevant to our later life. We go to university to indulge.
And have a great time, right?
Yeah, exactly. And some academic indulgence in a topic of interest rather than of use. So, yeah, I studied history at university. I then went to Bain & Company, which is a strategy consulting firm, and I was at their offices in London. I worked there for 8 years. I worked mostly on retail and consumer goods companies. So very vaguely in the world near whiskey, but in reality, not much use, if I'm honest. But while I was there, I got to travel a lot. So I lived in South Africa for 3 months. And I also got to spend a year working for a company called Innocent Drinks, who are a smoothie company. I think they sell in Germany as well.
They do.
And that was what really piqued my interest in what I would call now a purpose-led brand, like a brand that can do more than, or a company that can do more than just aim to make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there until mid-2013, and that's when I left to set up Nagneen.
And so you're a strategy lady, Bain & Company you were working, you said, right? It's
yeah.
A big strategy company, I understand that. And you studied in London, or where have you been?
I studied in Cambridge.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. Yeah, because I had the great privilege to study 1 year in Canterbury, University of Kent at Canterbury.
Oh, nice.
So I know what you're talking about, indulging yeah. during university and making an history course and stuff. I can sort of relate to that. And for that reason, I really love your country. So, yeah, so this sort of smoothie company, and then you got the idea, I want to go into drinks. But, you know, for me, it has been very strange to have seen this Arte documentary 5 years ago and then seeing this young lady and sort of going against all these complications in the whiskey industry. Do you have some family relation to that? Why go to Scotland? I mean, I imagine it must be a hell of a lot of money to found a company like that. And did you inherit anything? Or why does a London girl go to Scotland?
Well, a little bit of yes to all of those questions. So the idea for Nagneen originally came from the fact it's on my parents' farm. So the location, I guess, was the original spark of the idea. And it was actually my dad's idea to put a whiskey distillery in what were these old farm buildings, which is where the distillery now is. In 2012, I took a sabbatical from Bain, which was something they offered. I didn't take it to look at the whiskey distillery. I took it because why not? If they're offering you time off work, why not take it? So I took the sabbatical, I did some traveling and things, but I said to my family, well, I could write the business plan for this whiskey distillery because we keep talking about it and never doing anything about it. And it sounded like a fun thing to do. Give me a purpose to this time off. So I did. And that 3 months is when the distillery went from being an idea of something we could put in a building to the kind of genesis of what Nagneen would become. So that's the link to Scotland. I'm actually still based in London. My husband is a solicitor, so he is very tied to London. Yes, it's very expensive, and we had to raise a lot of money.
Your husband is a solicitor. I'm a lawyer as well, so I've studied law in Canterbury, yeah. So I know the system a bit. And yeah, if he has to go to the Old Bailey, since now Old Bailey's not, you know, I know. Fair enough.
Thankfully, he's not that kind of lawyer. He's the kind that writes the contracts, not argues about them when people fall out.
But that helps you, of course. I mean, if he's a contract guy, of course, that helps a lot for your company. But how do I have to imagine that? I mean, you have the idea. It's a family-owned ground somewhere in Scotland. Yeah. Let's make a distillery. Let's make a whiskey. How did you raise the money? Who gave the money? Did you full of loans, or do you have sort of people who own that thing with you together? Or
both, actually. Because when you're starting a distillery, you need a lot of money, and you probably need every source of money out there. So I took this sabbatical in 2012 and I wrote a business plan, identified some sources of funding, took an educated guess about what we might need. And then I had to go back to Bain. That was kind of the deal of taking the sabbatical. And I then my dad and I spent Saturday mornings trying to do this whiskey distillery. And by about May, I think 2013, it became clear that this thing was not going to happen unless we...
Full throttle.
Exactly. Someone did it more than part-time. And I had been looking to leave Bain anyway. I felt that the next stage was to become a partner, and I didn't want to sell consulting projects for a living. I just felt that my heart was not in that. And I could do the job very well, but it was not, you know, it was not where I saw my future. And I'd spent a bit of time interviewing for other roles, kind of strategy roles in-house, and you know, I went into that process full of hope of these interesting roles that might emerge, and then you realize that actually none of the roles are going to be what you thought they were. And so these two things collided, I guess. The distillery needed someone to focus on it, and I wanted to leave and hadn't found anything that I really grabbed my attention. So I said, well, why don't I do it? When am I going to get the chance to start a whiskey distillery again? And honestly, I did it without that much thought.
And you've been 30, right, at that time?
I would have been 30, exactly. So this was, yeah, exactly. I would have been exactly 30. I definitely didn't think I was going to be doing it 13 years later. If you told me that, I probably wouldn't have done it, in all honesty. I thought it was a two-year thing to get it up and running, and then I'd hand it over to someone else. My mentor at Bain, who's also an investor, told me you should plan to do it for at least 5 years. And I thought, pah, what does he know? And here I am, 13 years later. Yeah, so I ended up leaving in about July 2013. I then actually did still some consulting projects to keep the money coming in and to stop me going completely mad. I went back to Innocent and did some work for them and things. So that's how it all started. And then, yeah, it was a question of raising money. And I think raising money for a whiskey distillery has got to be one of the most difficult things you can do, because you've got no product for people to try. In my case, I had no background in the industry. It requires a vast amount of capital and then a long wait before you're going to see any returns. So it took a lot of asking around, and it was kind of not that hard to find people who put in 100K, but to find the cornerstone investor who put in more like the millions end of the spectrum was obviously very difficult. But we finally found that person in, I want to say late 2014, I guess. And mid 2015, we had the money in the bank. Then we started building.
Brilliant. How much turnover are you doing at the moment in 26?
Ooh, I can't tell you that, Tommy.
Okay.
All of our competitors would love to know. Sorry, that's really boring of me, but we just make a point of not disclosing that because there's lots of people looking.
But you have a black number down on your balance sheet. You know, you're making profit.
Not yet. No, definitely not.
Oh, okay.
Definitely not. No, I would not. I reckon it will take, I think to do whiskey properly, it's 10 years to make a profit. But we are nearly there. I'm hopeful that, you know.
Brilliant.
Next year might be the year.
How many people are working for you in the next
year? We have 20. Give or take 20. There's a bit of them.
20 people, 10 years to go. Of course, you don't have a product. You make a whiskey, and beforehand you can only sell this sort of other stuff, which is like sort of a gin, but not a gin either. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is what I bought at first. And I really loved your product. Not even the whiskey. I bought the stuff before. And
the botanical,
Yes, the botanical. I got totally fixed up on that one. And I really loved it. I loved the bottle. I loved your claim. Made by nature, not by rules. Who the heck had this great idea? Did the claim come from you? Or?
It did, actually, you know. And I am not a marketing person. That
bloody
sort
hell.
Of thing is... And that just... It just came to me. Yeah.
Bloody hell.
And I wrote it on the middle of a slide in, I don't know, probably 2016. So
Bloody hell. I love that. And my wife, you know, we put one of the empty whiskey bottles on the top shelf. We use it as a floral. You know, put flowers in there, you know. It's a lovely bottle and made by nature, not by roots. It's so great. Okay, it takes 10 years before you get some profit out of it. It's a long distance to go, a marathon, so to say.
But I think this is also normal with brands because you want to... Whiskey, you know, we want to be around for 200 years. It's not like a quick thing in any. So we want to build the brand in the right way and make the right investments. And I think that is the key to long-term success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea, or is it possible to talk about that? What are your main countries?
Well, actually, so UK is our biggest country at the moment. And actually, Germany is our second biggest country. We kind of launched, I guess, in 2018 when we made the botanical spirit for the first time, but properly we launched the whiskey in 2020, and that's when we started exporting and things. And when we started exporting, we exported only to Germany, France, and the Netherlands, and Italy. Italy was small, but Germany, France, and the Netherlands are obviously big whiskey markets. And in Germany, we partnered with Kirsch, who is still our importer in Germany, and... Then we had the Arte documentary that you referenced, and that really accelerated our growth in Germany massively. So actually for a while, because the UK was a bit more of a steady burn, Germany was the bigger market than the UK. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Understand that.
But the UK has now kind of caught up. We didn't have an Arte equivalent, because sometimes when you're trying to get the brand out there, you have these great bits of luck. Like Arte, and other times it's just more of a steady burn. And then at the moment, our third biggest market is the US, and that is actually the fastest growing one. So it may be at some point that the US starts overtaking, but we'll see.
Understood. You know, I'm living in a small town, you know, it's 10,000 people here in the middle, in the heart of Germany, you know, it's very small, 10,000, and with all the villages, we are 20,000, you know?
Yeah.
It's an healthy area, and we have a local wine dealer, so to say, Michele, my buddy.
Yeah.
He has your whiskey on his shelf, you know?
Yeah.
It's so bloody interesting. And once I've been to Edinburgh, like 2 years ago, and I asked for, do you have a Nagnin whiskey? And he looked at me totally flabbergasted what this German dick asked for whiskey in Edinburgh. And he had it, you know, not really on the top shelf. He had to grab somewhere, go below. And, here's the Nagnin whiskey. So I got it in the pub as well. So distribution is great. You said, I'm Bain Company, you know, strategy, all this crap, you know. I'm a lawyer. I was an HR guy. I quit the company as well. You know, looking for purpose for purple, you know. And from as I get to know to you at the moment, you know, you had the idea, I want to do something which makes a sense in life and not just... Yeah. Do some advisory crap, to put it this way. Excuse my French. And you talk much about sustainability, and you know it's a natural. It's a how do you say? It's an organic whiskey, which is pretty seldom. How did all this evolve? I mean, just step by step, by chance. You know, you're sitting on the table, and what has been the sort of your inner motor? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that was. That's a very easy question to answer because when I was on that sabbatical in 2012, so before I had quit Bain, and when I was writing the business plan, I took a trip to Isla, obviously a very famous whiskey island. And I went there to do some research. Kilhoman was there, which was the only kind of new small distillery in Scotland at the time. I wanted to see them. I just wanted a chance to go around lots of distilleries at the same time. I also really admired Bruichladdich. Obviously they were there. And I think I came away from that trip feeling that, A, there was a lot of focus on doing things the way they'd always been done in Scotch, and B, there was no one thinking about sustainability. And I think that first piece, the kind of focus on tradition, is very, it's what the whole industry is built on. And I think it's amazing, but it felt like there was both the space and the need for someone to do the more modern, forward-looking version and think about, well, how else could we make whiskey and try and push things forward? And I mean that in the broadest sense of the word. So it's not only about how we make the whiskey, it's also about thinking about presenting the whiskey differently. It's also thinking about making a botanical spirit. It's about how do we reach new audiences with Scotch? Because if you just do the whole backwards-looking thing all the time, gradually it's going to fade. And then the second thing, and this is particularly important with my innocent drink hat, if you like, was the sustainability side. And it doesn't take a genius to walk into a distillery and realize how much energy it uses. And it doesn't take a genius to figure out that it's an agricultural product. And those two things alone have big sustainability issues associated with them. And none of these distilleries that I went to were mentioned it. No one talked about how the barley was grown. No one talked about what their source of energy was because they were all using oil and gas. And that, to me, was also a big need and an opportunity to show and, I guess, pioneer the way for whiskey to be made more sustainably. And that's got two sides to it, both leading the way in the industry and hoping that we can have this bigger impact by pushing everyone else forward faster, but also making sure that the industry continues to have relevance to the next generation for whom this is really important. And the third bit is, I think, you know, the world doesn't need a new whiskey. And I think if you're going to start a new distillery in this day and age, you better do it well and in the right way, because otherwise I don't think I would be able to go to sleep at night.
I totally consent. I understand that one. And do you have any idea how many women are heavy users? I mean, how many men and women do you know that?
We never get great data on that because, as you can experience, the route from us to you is very fragmented. But we can get a kind of snippet of it by looking at who follows us on Instagram or, you know, who visits the website or who, you know. And I think, so what we know is that it's still mostly men that buy Nick Nian, but that we skew much more towards women than the average in the industry.
I bet you do.
And that, you know, that is such an important part of our mission, is to bring more people into whiskey. And that means having a more gender balanced men and women split. It means having younger people drink it. And I think everything that we see in our data, albeit very incomplete data, is that we're going in the right direction. But we also make a real effort to get to those people, right? So last weekend, we went to a craft beer festival in London to show Nick Nian. So we're trying to get to new drinkers. So, yeah.
Totally understood. You know, my wife told me, wow, that's a great bottle. And you know, she sometimes has some whiskey, not really, you know. And I'm a typical old white man, you know. And I grew up. With 19, I went to Scotland, to the Isle of Skye. I took my motorbike after my A-levels, drove up all the way to Edinburgh. On the way, I stopped by at Talisker, the distillery. Yeah. That was my first single Highland malt I drank with 19. You know, I had a fag, I had a cigarette, I had a whiskey, 11 o'clock in the morning, and I was totally stunned. You know, I thought, what the fuck? This is great. You know, I want to have that, you know?
I love it. What a great story.
Yes. You know, that was my first thing. And then, I loved it. And I was totally confused that after that, I've seen that all the single classical Highland malts like Oban and Talisker, they went through the roof and I couldn't understand. They couldn't have anticipated that. You know, where's all this whiskey coming from nowadays? Did they punch it? Did they sort of mix it? Or what the heck is going on there? I didn't understand that. But my point being an old white man, I got my whiskey neat, of course, no water. Are you crazy? Barman, of course, neat, you know. And I've learned from you, actually, Annabelle, honestly, this is no crap, you know. I've seen it on Arty or wherever that you took this little pipette thing and put some water in. And bloody hell, it's even better, even for me. You know?
Yeah.
And this is what my wife told me.
Yeah.
This is not so strong. Great. And then, so apparently you do the things right. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. And I think that was a personal insight of mine. And actually on the side of our bottle for Nick Nian Organic, not for our more limited editions, but for Nick Nian Organic, we actually suggest people also drink it with soda water over ice, because that's an even longer, like less strong version. And I mean, the first thing we say, by the way, is drink it how you like. I think one of the major issues with Scotch is that it constructed all of these rules around how you must drink it. And that did a great job in the 80s of creating this world of knowledge that you could get into and was very attractive. But as that has solidified, those have grown into like castle walls that can't be accessed by people. And I see part of our job being to gradually break down those walls and say, it's okay, come in, you're all welcome here. It doesn't matter if you don't want to drink neat spirits, because by the way, I didn't want to drink neat spirits. And my learning as I, because by the way, the other important thing that happened on that trip to Islay is that I fell in love with whiskey the drink. And before that, my husband likes whiskey. I had always tried his whiskey when he was having some, and I'd always thought it was disgusting.
Like Lagavulin and strong stuff, probably.
Well, I don't think it necessarily was Lagavulin. I think it was just the alcohol percentage. It wasn't the taste of, I mean, I'm sure I'd probably tried the peated ones and they were even worse, but it was the high strength alcohol that I didn't like. And I just wish someone given it to me with water in or over ice with soda or something, because it's not the actual taste of whiskey, it was the alcohol. And so, yeah, I think it's really important actually as an industry, but all I can control is what Nick Nguyen does, is that we start to step back a little bit from those rules. Well, I didn't want to call the distillery the name of the place because that's what everyone else does, and that's exactly what we're trying not to do. So we looked back in the Gaelic history books and we found an ancient goddess. So this is from pagan times, so pre-Christianity, called Nish Niohane. And she was known as a protector of nature and for walking her own path. I thought that so nicely summed up what we do, that we would adopt her. But Nish Niohane is incredibly long. It's like 13 letters, mostly consonants, no vowels. So we shortened it to become slightly easier to pronounce as Nick Nguyen. And the apostrophe after the C is meant to signal the fact we've taken letters out of the longer word.
Yeah, okay. You know, I'm a great fan of Outlander, this you know, this series, of course, with this Gaelic stuff, and I really like that one. Oh, yeah, understood. Great. And one step back, please, if you allow. Family-owned land? Are your parents Scots, or did they buy it as a whatever?
No, they are not Scots. We are, I always say, we're truly British. My parents grew up in Wales. I grew up in England. My grandmother was Scottish. And now my parents spend a lot of time in Scotland, obviously. They bought it in 2002. So just as I was at university, basically.
Annabelle, cool story. Well, what has been the biggest, I mean, in the Arte documentary, you talked a bit about, you know, that nobody wanted to sell you stuff, all the old men, you know, this young lady, get away, get out of my sight. And what, let's maybe talk a bit about, you know, my podcast is about people who have a passion. You have a passion, you have done something, you know, you have created the Nick Nguyen whiskey. And this is about great stories, but it's, of course, it's also about big fuck-ups, and what have you learned, and how did you get through that? What have you learned? How did you, why, where's the resilience, you know, where's the power coming from? So let's talk a bit about maybe a big fuck-up and how you managed to go through, if you like.
Oh, it's hard to know which one to pick, Tommy.
Don't pick two.
Well, I mean, I would say that building the distillery was extremely difficult. The distillery is very remote. It is far on a peninsula on the west coast of Scotland.
Great.
And especially when we have German visitors, they cannot believe the road that comes to the distillery. And everyone, all our German visitors that come say, Annabelle, in Germany, we would not have roads like this.
Well, this is so German, hey.
And so one of the things, as I said, I wanted to try and make Nick Nguyen as sustainable as possible. And one of the obvious things you have to fix is the energy source. Mm-hmm. Because distilling is very energy intensive and I definitely didn't want to use oil to fuel the distillery. So we decided to use biomass because we have a commercial forest basically right next to the distillery. And I think it makes sense to use what you have on site. But to distill, you need high-pressure steam. So we needed a biomass boiler that could produce high-pressure steam, and those are not made in the UK because, frankly, the UK is not very sophisticated when it comes to biomass. But Germany and Austria are very sophisticated when it comes to biomass. So I actually spent 3 days driving around Germany and Austria visiting biomass factories, which was one of the most extraordinary experiences, especially because I also got to go to a commercial laundry and a chocolate factory at the same time, which were both using biomass boilers. Uh-huh. And in a little diversion, but in the UK, we have a very famous children's story called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Uh-huh. And really, this chocolate factory was like going back to my childhood, and they're just pulling bits of chocolate off the line and giving it to you. I was like, this is the best work trip ever. Anyway, we ended up sourcing the boiler from a combined German-Austrian team, if you like. Mm-hmm. And that was all fine. It's a really high quality boiler. Then we were talking about the logistics of how we get the boiler to the site. And the German, or I think it was probably the Austrian team, were absolutely insistent that they wanted to send their trucks all the way to the distillery. Mm-hmm. And they could not comprehend how the road to the distillery was not suitable for an Autobahn truck. Uh-huh. And so there was me, there was our contractor, and then there was the biomass supplier. And we had to, it was very difficult discussions with them, basically, to say, you cannot send the boiler on these trucks. And eventually, the contractor threatened to send the police to the ferry to stop them. That is how insistent they were. However, they finally agreed, but actually the funny thing was, as the truck was coming up through Glencoe, so still hours from the distillery, which is, you know, it's two-track road, but it's quite narrow. The wing mirror got knocked off. So by this point, they were very happy not to come all the way to the distillery. So that worked out okay. We then, once we got the boiler close to the distillery, we had to work out how we were going to get a crane down the road to lift the boiler off the truck. Mm-hmm. And the village at the end of this road has about 50 houses, and a big crane had never been down the road. So, you know, there's a worry just about the structural integrity of the road alone. And there's lots of these old stone bridges over the rivers. So that was, it all worked out okay. That was, and I find that the things that you worry about, actually, probably because you worried about them and put in place the mitigation, turn out okay. But the other thing that I didn't worry about was our cooling pond. Mm-hmm. So distilling uses a lot of water, and most of the water use goes into the cooling of the spirit. After it's evaporated, you need to condense it. So in the condensers, you use a lot of water. Mm-hmm. And most distilleries are built on a river. That's why there are so many distilleries around Speyside, because they take the water from the Spey. Mm-hmm. Others use a cooling tower, and that's what the engineers tried to get us to do. But I really didn't want to use a cooling tower. It's complex, it's energy intensive, it's chemically intensive. So we had this idea of digging a pond. And so we did. Early in 2016, during the build process, we dug this pond. And I was actually looking at photos of this on Monday, because something went wrong with it. And so we dug this pond, and my parents had dug other lakes on the around about before, and you just dig them. It's Scotland, they fill up, no problem. Mm-hmm. But by August 2016, this pond has not filled up. It is like a muddy soup on the bottom.
Okay.
So probably the biggest challenge we had was how to fix that. So we figured we needed to line it, fine. But if you know you're going to line a pond, when you dig it, you put a drain in, because you can't have any water under the liner. But we have now dug this pond and there's no drain. So we have to figure out how to drain it. And then we have to, so this all takes months and months. And then by October, we now have 2 months left to line this pond. And to line it, you need to suspend them. Anyway, you need a day in October or November on the west coast of Scotland when it's not windy and it's not raining.
Okay. Well, which is very rarely, I suppose.
Very rare. But we did it through some perseverance. So yeah, those were a couple of the challenges we had when building.
This production process of whiskey, I mean, how did you get 20 guys working on site, you know, roughly 20 guys who have the expertise, you know? And so I imagine you have one or two whiskey masters and they're doing the product, I suppose. How did you get those guys or ladies?
Well, I think if we go back a step, actually, most important person was this guy, Dr. Jim Swan. Mm-hmm. So we started working with Jim in 2012. So this is before I've left Bain. Mm-hmm. And he was critical, to be honest, to the whole thing. Because if we hadn't had Jim, we'd never have even raised the money. Because the investors would have looked at us quite rightly and said, you've got no idea how to make whiskey. Mm-hmm. So Jim is, when we were working with him, was about 70. He'd been in the whiskey industry all his life. He'd done really interesting things. He'd pioneered research into maturation and how it works. But later in his career, he'd made his name as someone who could make great young whiskey. Because mm-hmm. if you are a new distillery, you can't wait 15 years to sell your whiskey.
Yes.
So meeting Jim and working with him was absolutely key to the success of the whole thing. And he helped us with equipment sourcing, like going to the right people, not how to make it, but, you know, these people will make good thing. But more importantly, he helped us with the recipe of how to make great whiskey. That's the mashing temperatures, the mashing time, the milling ratios, the fermentation times, the yeast, the cut points, everything. Mm-hmm. He wrote that recipe. And he came to the distillery in February 2017. So we were meant to start production in January 2017. And that's also when the second key person, Gordon, started. So Gordon is our distillery manager, and he had worked at Diageo for basically 30 years before he came to Nick Nguyen. He has had an amazingly varied career at Diageo, including as a coppersmith, basically in maintenance, which if you're as remote as we are, is key, and also, and then as a distiller. So he had the kind of full skill set, and he was based at Oban, which is not that far away, and loved the West Coast, and basically was ready for another step in his career outside of Diageo. So in January 2017, Gordon started working for us. We're meant to be in production, but we're not. And Jim has a visit scheduled in early February to kind of see the first output from the distillery and help us tweak things. Obviously, there is no output because we're not in production yet, but Jim and Gordon and I spend the whole day together. And Jim was not a man to write things down. It's not like he gave me a book and said, this is how you do it. It was all verbal, but that day, I kind of felt the need to interview out of him everything and get like some plan on paper. So I've still got my notes scribbled from that day, pages and pages of A4, where we kind of went through all of the detail. And then we never saw Jim again. He died very suddenly 2 weeks later.
Oh my God.
So that was a massive shock because he'd never tried the spirit. And he would also have gone on to be our blender. So Gordon's expertise is in the making of the whiskey and the, you know, the process management, but he's not a blender. That's not his skill set. So Jim would have done that. So when we came to launch in 2020, it would have been Jim that we'd be sending car samples to, and he'd, but yeah, we didn't have him. So that was a massive shock and a bit of a, you know, so we started distilling eventually. We filled the first cask on the 21st of March. And yeah, it was very hard. But I think thank God we had that meeting with Jim. And also, you know, thank God that we'd found him, because I think we'd got so much out of it to then. So a lot of the basic principles that we distill on are from Jim. Gordon is the person that makes it happen day to day. And then Matt is our blender who does the role that Jim would have done.
Did you make a special edition for Jim yet?
No, we haven't yet. You know what? There was a plan and it just never happened. Was a collaboration between lots of distilleries that Jim had helped, which would have been a really nice idea. So a barrel from here, a barrel from there, blend it all together. But yeah, we haven't managed to make that happen yet.
Okay, no worries. Understood. So that must have been a really big setback. Got it. Annabelle, you have, how many girls or women are working for you?
Oh, sorry. How many women? It's about half and half.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it always has been, interestingly, not as a strategy, but just the way it happened, which I love.
And you are CEO, founder, and mostly owner. Not alone owner, as I've learned, probably, but...
only a small owner, if we're honest.
Okay, fair enough. But CEO and founder, and you are...
Correct.
You're the lady behind, and you made the great claim, made by nature, not by rules. What kind of leader are you?
Oh, that's a difficult question, Tommy. You probably have to ask my team rather than asking me.
They're going to hear that. Kind of,
yeah, exactly. I think, what kind of leader am I? I try to create a culture that is very collaborative and not too hierarchical. Mm-hmm. I think teamwork is really important, and I try to, I guess, lead by example in that. So, you know, mm-hmm. quite happy unloading the dishwasher at the distillery mm-hmm. as I am writing mm-hmm. board materials. I think I have a very clear vision for what I want Nick Meehan to be and why I started it. So I think that is helpful. I think everyone in the team knows why we exist and what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And I think what has been great about that over time is that it's attracted like-minded people to the team.
Yes.
And then that, which was cool to see, gets an energy of its own.
Yes.
You know, to begin with, that had to come from me, but then actually it evolves and grows within the ecosystem mm-hmm. of the team, which is nice.
Well, obviously, I mean, if you're mostly in London and you're not on site on a weekly basis, you need a team, of course, who knows what to do and who love you, who love your, I mean, not literally, but who love yeah. what they are doing and yeah. who respect your input. When do you go really nuts? I mean, you are not a person to scream around and hit on the table, I suppose. But what are things? And how do the people know, oh fuck it, Annabelle is going nuts. We got to be careful. What are those things or situations?
Oh, good question. I mean, it's very rare, to be honest. Mm-hmm. What annoys me the most? I think probably when people just haven't taken enough care on what they're doing. You know, either we've discussed doing something and someone's not bothered listening, or they've just not thought things through. I think as long as someone tries their best, mm-hmm. if they fuck up, excuse my French, I don't mm-hmm. like, you know, they've tried their best. Mm-hmm. I think it's when people are lazy or don't think about things that annoys me.
Yeah, fair enough. It's the same with me. Did you realize, you know, after this COVID crisis, and did you realize that people get a bit more stressed, nervous, angry, aggressive? How is the situation in England or in the UK? Has the society in England changed with all these crises we have, all this world situation, bollocks that is going on? I don't want to go into this in detail, but have you sensed anything?
I think... Yes, I think it has. I don't think it's a direct result of COVID. Mm-hmm. I think it's maybe an indirect result of COVID because I think mm-hmm. everyone's got less money and they're all stressed about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, COVID was a very weird experience for us at Nick Meehan because we, at the time, because we hadn't yet launched the whiskey, it was still me and five people at the distillery. Mm-hmm. And I had been going, so in 2017 when we started, I was there every other week. So I was very present. Then my first daughter was born and I took a few months off and then I started going about every 3 weeks. But COVID meant I couldn't go. So for the first time since mm-hmm. January 2017, I didn't go for months and months and months and months and months. Mm-hmm. And it turned out the team was actually quite fine with that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay.
But then since COVID, because we launched the whiskey in 2020, the team has grown massively. We went from 6 to over a few years to nearly 20. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't see any massive changes, I think, that okay. I can discern, mostly because we also went through so much change, it's hard to pick out what caused yeah. what.
Fair enough. It's been a broad question. Fair enough. I got two questions about secrets. How did you create this great taste of the whiskey? You know, my people will always say I'm too much of a fanboy of the whiskey, but while I am a fanboy of a whiskey,
yeah.
so let it put it this way. But what is the secret of the taste of the whiskey? Why is it so good? Do you have any idea why?
Yes, I have a very exact idea. So the simple answer is it's largely Jim Swan's recipe influence. But the more detailed answer is that to make a great whiskey, you need a great spirit and you need to put it into good quality casks. Obviously, behind those two things, in particular behind the spirit, there's quite a lot of complexity as to how you do it. But it's, you know, I think our philosophy is really just to take time and money and invest in every single bit of the spirit production. So that goes all the way from buying organic barley, which is much more expensive, but it tastes way better, to using multiple yeasts in the fermentation, to fermenting very slowly, to distilling very slowly, all of these things that the big distilleries don't have the time to do. And then we invest in good casks, and then there's the blending, which is the magic at the end. That's the bit that's still done by nose. It's not a computer.
Yes. And this blending process, did you say then, hey, Matt, I need it a bit more sweet and more spicy? And are you standing there? And are you the lady who is giving the input, I don't want this taste, I want it a bit other. Let's go there.
Yes. Well, what really happened, it was quite a complicated winding road to get there, because in early 2020, I started to really panic about this situation, because we needed to release a whiskey. I didn't want to do the blending on my own. I didn't feel like I had the skills to do it. But there were not many blenders floating around the industry, apart from the, and I don't mean this to come out the wrong way, but the people who'd retired from the big distilleries. And that didn't feel philosophically right for what we were trying to do. I wanted to create a whiskey that was different, not just the same as what Pernod Ricard have been putting out for 70 years. But there wasn't anyone, you know, now actually there are, and it's really interesting to see how the industry's evolved over 10 years, but at the time there wasn't. Anyway, I recruited, and I had been talking to some people, but I'd never quite found the right person. I had recruited this guy, Matt, on the 1st of April, 2020, which in the UK is April Fool's Day. I don't know whether you have the same concept in...
We have the same concept, yes.
And so I had offered him the job sometime in early March, when COVID was not a thing. And his role was going to be on trade. So bars and restaurants, sales, basically, brand ambassador, but basically sales. And his start date was the 1st of April. Anyway, as you will remember, by the 1st of April, 2020, there was not a single bar or restaurant open in the country.
Right.
So the good thing is that Matt is a very talented chap, and he quickly pivoted from bar and restaurant sales so he's an ex-bartender, so he knows flavor, and he's also a product developer. So he started making cocktails, but we then started also talking about the creation of what would become Nick Meehan Single Malt. And he said, look, Annabelle, I reckon you and I can do it together. Don't worry about trying to recruit someone from the industry. They're just going to give you something that is what, you know, Diageo or Chivas want to produce, not what Nick Meehan is. Let's do it. And so we did. In the early days, I was very involved, like agreeing with Matt what the flavor profile is. These days, I don't taste, you know, I don't blend with him, obviously, but...
Of course. Annabelle, the next question is probably pretty difficult. I wouldn't know if I could answer that question if you posed it to me. But let's give it a try. What do you think is the secret of the success of Annabelle Thomas as a person, as a leader, as a businesswoman, as an entrepreneur, as a human being? What is your secret of success?
Well, I think maybe two things. One is having a different point of view. I think it's helpful to have come into the... I didn't realize this at the time, but most people have been in the industry for years. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't. And I honestly didn't occur to me 13 years ago, but you can now see it. I didn't have all of those expectations of how it's done as baggage, which has allowed me to look at things differently and just take, I guess, things from first principles. And also, by the way, bring experience from other industries and different ways of doing things. But I think perhaps what's even more important is just not giving up.
Mm-hmm. Resilience and not giving
up. Keeping going, I think, is honestly the most important.
And where does this strength come from, this keep going?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. You'd probably have to ask a psychologist.
Do you have siblings, or are you alone?
I do.
Sword?
I've got a younger sister.
Okay.
I think she's probably the same.
And your parents, what have they been doing as a job?
So my mum is a trained counsellor, although when we were growing up, she didn't work. My dad, the best way to describe what he's done is like a general businessman. They actually lived in Germany, in Cologne, for 3 years. He worked for Ford Motor Company. And then they lived in the US and then they moved back to England. He's also worked in media. He ran the prison system in the UK. Crazy job. He's worked for hospital-based businesses. He's done all sorts of different things.
But that gives an explanation. I mean, a very broad and colorful man and business life. And then having two daughters who are, as you said, a bit the same and strong and resilient and brilliant. Well, this is maybe too much, but I just try it. How would the solicitor describe you? I mean, your husband.
Oh.
what does he love most about Annabelle?
Oh, I don't know. I should ask him that, shouldn't I?
It's really a tricky question. I know.
No. I'm stumped by that question. It's very rare that I get asked a question that I can't answer, but I don't know. Maybe he loves that I'm not afraid to challenge the rules.
Not afraid to challenge the rules. That's a great, great sentence. Annabelle, before I pose my last question, is there anything you want to tell our audience, anything on your heart still you want to talk about?
I think the thing that is really on my mind at the moment, and I think this is maybe particularly as a result of the overall political environment we're operating in and these awful wildfires that are across Europe at the moment, is that we mustn't give up on our pursuit of a more sustainable world. And I think one of the many things I love about Germany is how focused everybody is on that. And that is very different to England. And I notice this whenever I travel in Germany, is that there is like an innate understanding of the importance of that. And someone once said to me in Germany, Annabelle, you have to understand, we've had Angela Merkel telling us how important this is for 20 years. So we all understand it. But I think there is just a risk of it slipping down everybody's agendas. And I think that is what I want everyone to keep thinking about.
Yeah, that is very, very good. My dearest Annabelle, if I can say, if I'm allowed to put it like that.
Of course.
it's not my own language, it's a bit shady sometimes. Which words can I use and which not? And, it's not my native language. My last question, dear Annabelle. What is your advice for content life?
Yes, this is also very tricky, Tommy. Can I have sort of two answers?
Please.
There's one practical one and one more philosophical one. The practical one is to get lots of exercise.
Mm-hmm.
The more philosophical one is, I mean, this is kind of obvious, but the teachings of Stoicism and to try and be happy with what you've got, I think, is totally critical. This sometimes works in conflict with my mission to change things in whiskey. So I would say this, I have a bit of an internal battle with this, but I still think that that's the right approach.
Thank you very much, Annabelle. Thank you very much for being here and thank you very much for taking all the time.
Oh, thank you, Tommy, for having me. It's been just a pleasure.
So thank you, everybody. If you like this talk, feel free to applaud on all channels and listen in again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.